You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel.
Hello.
And Daniel Freiber.
Hello.
Chats. Hello, Daniel. How's your ankle, first of all, Daniel?
I'm not too bad. I'm in rehab. I've even been doing some cycling. Uphill cycling. I only do uphills. I only do uphill cycling. I don't do
uphill,
any other kind of cycling.
How do you get back down again?
I wouldn't call it cycling the way I get down. I just sort of mince down. I just sort of fall down to the bottom of the incline again and go back up.
Unconventional.
How did you injure your ankle?
I was trail running. I was chasing personal bests on Strava, I think.
What an idiot.
Anyway.
will you be fit for the classics?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that I'll be back in action in a couple of weeks, actually. A key part of my rehabilitation is skateboarding. I've been skateboarding a lot. Not sure whether that's a good idea.
What a series of images you're painting for us here. I think we'll have to send Rob Hatch out with a camera for some photographic evidence of this.
It's highly unconventional. I almost re-injured myself celebrating one of Arsenal's goals in the North London derby against Tottenham at the weekend. But anyway.
Well, hopefully you'll be fit again soon, Daniel, because you've got some important work to do for the Cycling Podcast over the next week or so, attending training camps in Mallorca.
I think I'm going to three in the next week. Katusha, Bora, and Lotto. One of the Lottos. The red one. Red Lotto.
I'm going to the yellow Lotto next week as well. So going to have lots of content for the next few weeks and into the new year. Chaps, we gather today in early December in London, you and me at least, Lionel. It's a very sad week in the world of cycling, and especially in the English-speaking world of cycling, because at the weekend we got news of the very sudden and tragic death of Paul Sherwin at the age of 62, known to millions, I guess, as a co-commentator with Phil Liggett of the last 30, 40 years of the Tour de France. It started in 1986, didn't he? So that's just over 30 years ago. And before that, he was a rider, rode the Tour de France 7 times. So in this episode, we'll be largely reflecting on Paul Sherwin's life and legacy. And we'll hear from Phil Liggett, his co-commentator, and a few other people who knew him over his life and his different roles. We'll hear from John Herity, who rode with him. We'll hear from Tim Harris, who rode for him, because Sherwin was briefly a director sportif as well. And we'll reflect, as I say, a little bit on the life of someone whose death has really left a big impression on people, and the reaction to it has been pretty overwhelming for Phil Liggett, as you'll hear when we hear from him a bit later on. But Lionel, do you have a news roundup for us this week as well?
Yeah, I do. The Track World Cup went to Daniel's second home, Berlin. Daniel conveniently wasn't there for the indoor cycling. The British women had an outstanding long weekend. They won the team pursuit. Katie Archibald won the Omnium. Laura Kenny and Emily Nelson won the Madison. So they're in great form. And the next round is in London, just before Christmas. So the track season in full swing at the moment. On the road, we've heard that Omar Fraile of the Astana team was involved in a car accident a couple of days ago. Fraile rides for Astana, won the Tour de France stage in Mons this year. He was driving back from a Criterium in Madrid with his girlfriend. They were both injured, seriously but not life-threatening injuries. So we wait to hear how Fraile's recovery goes and when he'll be back on the bike, and we wish him all the best. The Drops women's team launched a crowdfunding effort to keep the show on the road, and although they haven't quite reached the crowdfunded target, they've had some offline donations as well, and have confirmed that they will be in the peloton in 2019, so that is good news for them. A couple of retirements that have been announced in the last week. Phil Dignan, Team Sky rider, also rode for Cervelo, He is retiring. He, of course, is Lizzie Deignan's husband, and Phil Deignan is going to be a stay-at-home dad, we gather, while
Lizzie Baby Deignan Orla was born in September, and Lizzie Deignan is returning to racing, of course, next year.
I don't know why I sounded surprised there. I quite like the idea of being a stay-at-home dad. Maybe that will. Maybe I'll do that as well.
Send your other half out to do the podcast, Lionel.
She'd love that. She'd absolutely love that. It certainly
we'd quite like that as well.
Introduce a bit of you know, common sense and decorum to proceedings. Anyway, another retirement and a surprise one. This one, Danny Rowe, who is retiring. I thought she would carry on racing.
Very surprised. Yeah. She had her best ever season on the road this year with Mariana Voss's team, and that team is becoming CCC next year, women's team to go alongside the men's team. They've signed Ashley Moulman-Passio. I was very surprised to see that she's retired, yeah.
I tell you who's not retiring, chaps. Contrary to some things you might have read, King Kenny Elizonde. I've seen some speculation online that he doesn't have a contract for next year. The Team Sky, the Matchbox Team Sky climber. I understand that he does have a contract.
Good not retiring news there, Daniel.
Good not retiring news. Yeah.
No, I'll tell you what, he's too young to retire. He's too young to retire.
Well, there are a lot of good riders who still don't have contracts, who are trying to get contracts.
True.
And it was thought that Elizonde was one of them. But in fact, last year he signed a contract extension with Sky, and it was for 2 years. So he'll also be with Sky next year. One rider whose future is uncertain is the peacock of Sandrigo, Filippo Pozzato. We still don't know what he's going to do next
Chiro
year.
Promised us some news on that imminently.
He's playing a lot of roller hockey at the moment, which may or may not be related to my skateboarding.
Pozzato is the only retired rider who has a contract.
Does he have a contract?
Correct.
Does he have a contract?
No, I mean, for the last 3 years, he's been retired with a contract.
Yeah, he retired about 4 or 5 years ago, didn't he?
I tell you what, it's going to extend the podcast if we have to do riders not retiring news.
Geraint Thomas isn't retiring.
He's not as fat. He's also not as fat as everyone is saying, is he? I mean, I've seen a lot of talk online about how rotund he's looking, and I think he's probably about 6 or 7 kilos overweight, isn't he? But that's
We know now that he listens to the podcast. So, yeah, I agree. Geraint Thomas is not as fat as everybody is saying.
This is because of the Team Sky press kit that came out in a few days ago, unveiling their new jersey for 2019. They've gone back to a sort of midnight blue and black right after a year in white. And
The white jersey midlife crisis that a lot of teams go through. Mappe did it, US Postal did it, Quickstep did it, and the experiment is generally curtailed after 1 year.
Well, it's white is not a flattering colour for this slightly more rotund figure, is it? So black is generally thought
to
be slimming.
They've reintroduced black purely to save Geraint Thomas's blushes.
let's not dig ourselves any deeper into this particular hole.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, RAFA. And a reminder that this Christmas or this festive season, they'll be doing their Festive 500 again. 500 kilometres between Christmas and New Year. Lionel, you took on that challenge last year. Fell a little bit short, if I recall.
I fell a long, long way short. It's really hard to do. As a challenge, it is perfectly pitched because it sounds easy, and then you look at what's required, and it's actually quite difficult to... it requires a lot of dedication. A week, really, when everybody should have their feet up, enjoy a mince pie and a glass of sherry.
Even as the host of our new Explore series, you're not... you know, maybe riding your bike a little bit more. You've been inspired by some of these incredible stories.
It's inspiring, and I'm not having a go at anyone who tries to do it. I think it's amazing. But you're in the lap of the gods when it comes, certainly in this country, where you're reliant on the weather. You know, you can have a couple of really bad days weather when you don't fancy going out, and then
Lionel,
I guess that's the whole point.
Daniel, do you think 500 kilometres could be possible on your skateboard, and would that qualify for the...
Is there no equivalent that could be applied to my uphill cycling? Is there not? Could I not do 5,000 altitude meters? Would probably be reasonable, actually, in a week. Possible.
That's, yeah. Okay.
Not
that's
in
fine.
Watford. If you're tough in Watford,
if you're committing, or even in not Watford, you're, if you're committing to doing that, that's
I'm not
fine.
Committing.
We'll keep
I'm
an eye
definitely
on that.
Not committing. I'm just hypothesising what might be possible.
Okay. Well, as I said at the start, chaps, it has been a sad week. I think everybody who follows cycling has been hit quite hard by the death of Paul Sherwin at a young age, 62, died apparently of heart failure, and it's been quite incredible the outpouring and the of you know comment and tributes being paid to him. But it makes sense when you think that anybody at all who's follows cycling in the English speaking world has sort of had their hand held in the early stages at least by Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin. He's been doing it, as I said earlier, for more than 30 years.
I think you're right, Rich, particularly when we think about the English speaking world and also the way, the extent to which people become infatuated with cycling when they first discover it. And we've talked about this before, that it's this weird and exotic world which seems slightly impenetrable at first. And a lot of, particularly American fans, but English-speaking fans in general, discovered professional cycling in the Lance, the controversial Lance Armstrong years. And their sort of translator, or one of their key translators, was Paul Sherwin. And I think some of the passion that they had and developed for cycling then was almost, well, it was also applied to the people who were taking them on that journey and holding their hand. And I think that's one reason why he's being so fondly remembered this week.
Well, I mentioned earlier that I spoke to Phil Liggett, who, of course, formed part of that incredible duo with Sherwin for so many years. He mentioned, actually, once we'd finished recording, that the paperwork had just arrived this week for their stint at the Tour Down Under in January, where Sherwin obviously will not be at his side, and that was terrible timing, and just brought home to him the sadness of next year and not having his mate and his co-commentator by his side. Liggett, I should say, was speaking near his home in South Africa, and led to quite a surreal moment when a giraffe walked nearby. You'll hear it in the interview. But here's what Phil Liggett, an upset Phil Liggett, had to say earlier this week.
I don't know where to start, to be honest, because the grief hasn't got to me yet, because I've been walking in a bubble. But from the moment Catherine told me, I was stunned.
I mean, you knew Paul, obviously, extremely well, so you knew him. But are you surprised by just how many other people feel like they knew him as well?
No, when we saw it, I've never known an outpouring of sentiment and love for anybody in the business. In all the years that I've been here, I've done it for 50 years now. So there's never been an outpour of sentiment like this. He must have hit so many people's hearts. And he was what you got, you know. He was an entertainer. And I suppose we both are. That's why we do it. You can't talk for 7 hours on a boring cycle race. That's not possible. So we want people to stay tuned, and that's the way we've gone to the business. And Paul, it shocked me, of course. I just wish and hope he knows the enjoyment he gave people and the love that they've given him. Because today and all afternoon, I'm offline at the house, but when they come online up here, the computer just got steam coming out of it. It's just unbelievable.
Phil, I went back and I looked at some of the early footage of Paul's first times commentating with you, and it was quite amazing just how he changed over the years as a co-commentator.
Yes.
Was that you know, improving in that role, was that something that was important to him and that you saw him working at?
Oh, absolutely. Paul became a journalist without any training. That was the difference. He was a cyclist, but a very clever boy. His university degree is in newspaper technology, you know, making paper. And he was in no way a journalist. And, of course, at the time I took him on board and asked if he wanted to try and work with me, and he said yes. He'd never seen a commentary box. He'd never written a word in his life. And then at times he was having to write scripts, and he used to always read me his scripts, and I'd correct them and say, no, you need to say it like you're talking, not like you're writing. And he learned every time. And then he used to read my copy over to the Daily Telegraph because I was commentating at the same time. And it just all became part of the job. And he learned and learned. And, of course, in the years to follow, he had to change his attitude of being an analyst to being a co-commentator, because there's only so much limit in that life before you're too far away from the people you're talking about. And so because of that, Paul changed to a co-commentator, and he took like a duck to water to it.
Why did you think he would be good in that role? You obviously got to know him as a writer, but why did you think he'd be good behind the microphone?
Because we were the same people. I'm just going to tell you, mate, at the moment, Richard, there's a giraffe walking within 5 feet of my car. That's by the by. Paul and I, when he was a cyclist, I was finished, but I was already reporting him. He was in the Altrincham Road Club in Manchester, and I was invited as guest of honour to the club dinner to wish him well as he was going to Paris now, to France, the Boulogne-Billancourt, and try to get a pro contract, which he got, of course, and stayed a pro for 10 years. So we always had a relationship, but there's no friendship then. We just cyclist and a reporter. During the tour, the friendship built, because in those days there was no food stops for the journalists on the tour. So I used to watch the riders signing in. Paul would be in the line with the cyclists going to the grapefruit server hatch in the middle of the street, and he said, "I'll get you half a grapefruit." So he used to bring me half a grapefruit pack, because that was our food for the day. There's nothing like the tour these days. And the riders looked after themselves, because they were not following and stopping in the streets and stealing things. And so we built a friendship. And his attitude, his carefree attitude, the way he loved his job, loved helping people. When he came to the finish of the stage on Paris-Nice in 85, I said, "Paul, I've heard the rumour you're stopping." He says, "Yeah, 2 years, I'll be with a team I can't tell you about next year in Britain, then I'm finished for good." I said, "Well, before you sign for this new team, put a clause in your contract, no racing in July, and I'm going to try and get you in television." He says, "I'll give it a go." That was his word, "I'll give it a go." And that happened, it came to fruition. In fact, it was to be Rally Banana, and George Shaw rang me, who is the new manager, and said, "Hey, Paul's put this strange clause, asked us to write this into his contract. What do you mean, no racing in July?" I said, "George, he's got to think of the future. He can come by me as a co-commentator on the telly. Rally won't mind if we put a motif on the polar neck for him. ITV won't mind, rather. And he's got something to go after." He says, "Fine, all I want to know, done." And that's how it started.
You could never have foreseen, you know, how long you'd work together and, you know, what a close partnership you would form.
No, we couldn't. Paul tells me every year on the tour, we're the longest running sports duo, stayed together as permanent commentators as a duo in the history of any sport in the world. There was a basketball team in America, but apparently it's gone now. And Paul was very proud of telling me that every time. "We've been together the longest, you know." I said, "All right, get on with it, let's go." And that's the way it is. No, I didn't think, we've never had a strong a crossword. I've been very proud of the fact we never jump on each other. He always accepted I was the lead commentator. He was ready to move in whenever necessary. And if he saw things that he wouldn't jump on my commentary, he'd write it down and say, "Look to your right," or "Look at the back of the bunch." And it helped you that way. And we knew exactly what to do. If I introduced the show, Paul would pick up from me, would not repeat what I said, and would carry on, and I wouldn't come back until I knew he'd made his last word. We were a perfect couple, as many people told us. We were like an all-married couple. We even bickered together in the commentary box. The other commentators pissed themselves laughing, because that's what we did. Biggest thing, I think, that cycling commentators make, weren't so many in my earlier days, there's plenty now, is that they're talking to the cyclists. They're talking about the kids who are riding bikes. And I've always said to Paul, I said, "Look, we've got 150 million viewers on the peak nights around the world. Now, don't tell me there's that many bike riders. It's probably a very small proportion watching the show. The bike riders know bike riding. They'll turn the sound off. But the people, we want to stay there, where we've got to talk to them and tell them a lot more than how old Eddie Merckx is." And so we talked to the birds, we talked to the chateaus, we talked to the country. France, between the two of us, I think we know France better than Great Britain. And when we were talking to South Africa or talking to Australia or New Zealand, we knew those countries too. And we knew those listeners were listening. So we made them feel at home with us. And it never failed. And Paul moved very quickly to that way of thinking as well. And for that reason, you know, we became an unbelievable team.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Harry's. Harry's Razors, that is. And Harry's Razors have a special offer for Cycling Podcast listeners, offering a trial set for £3.95, which is basically the cost of the postage. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling. What do you get with your trial set? You get the weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Richard, you're stroking your face.
Well, Lionel, this is normally the point at which you ask me when I last shaved with my Harry's razor. I want to ask you, what would it take for you to take one of these lovely, reassuringly heavy Harry's razors to that old mane of yours?
You want to see me? You don't want to see the what's behind the mask, Rich, honestly.
But I asked, what would it take? Money?
A lot.
A free Harry's set?
I'm not committing to this. I'm not falling for this.
Maybe if you don't complete the Festive 500 this year?
Oh, that's cruel, Rich. That is cruel.
Watch this space. Anyway, I can certainly endorse the Harry's razor. I'm still shaving happily with my Harry's razor and new blades. So you can get started shaving with Harry's today if you're a Cycling Podcast listener. Claim your trial set for just £3.95. Get that delivered to you. It includes the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel and travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling. So we heard there from Phil Liggett, Lionel. I mean, Sherwin is known to most people as a co-commentator, and it's fascinating listening back to old clips when he first started in the late 80s. How unpolished he was then as a co-commentator. You know, when he started out, he just finished as a rider. He was pretty raw. Liggett, as he told us, you know, reckoned he had potential. But he worked hard at it, and he improved an awful lot as in that role over the years. And the Sherwin from those years, very different to the finished article. We'll hear a little compilation later on, actually, of some of his commentary over the years.
Yeah, I think, well, they defined what cycling commentary is, really, Phil and Paul. And they weren't just a partnership. They were a double act in the a sort of non-comedic Morecambe and Wise, or, you know, one of the sort of the famous double acts of TV comedy. The two names just go together. They are synonymous with one another. And I think in the early days, certainly when I first started watching the Tour de France on Channel 4, you know, the thing that sticks in my mind is how often Phil Liggett said Paul Sherwin has ridden the Tour de France 7 times. You know, he wanted to give Sherwin, even in the sort of fledgling days of his commentary, he wanted to give him that authority that Sherwin had just recently come out of the peloton and was able to take the viewers inside the race. And a lot of the commentary, even to, you know, the very recent years when I've caught some of it, obviously I'd not heard a lot of their commentary in recent years because I've been at the Tour de France, but the style of it remained welcoming to the newcomers, explaining to people who might not understand how the peloton works, what's going on, why are they riding at the front, how do they draft, all of these things. You know, Phil and Paul really did usher in generations of cycling fans in the UK, the US and Australia particularly, and a huge amount of our understanding of how the sport works came from their commentary. But it's easy to forget that Paul Sherwin was a pro rider. You know, he was a British rider who made it on his own in an era where British riders were not going to Europe to race. He kind of fell between the two great eras of British riders going across and racing in the Tour de France, the sort of Tom Simpson, Barry Hoban era at the end of the 60s. Barry Hoban, of course, had a long career and just about overlapped with Paul Sherwin. But in the 1970s, only four British riders rode the Tour de France. Barry Hoban, Michael Wright, who was born in the UK but was really, to all intents and purposes, Belgian. Bill Nixon, who did around half of the Tour in 77. And then Paul Sherwin made his debut in 78. It was a really barren decade for British riders. And the journey that Sherwin went on, joining the Fiat team in 78, which was run by Raphael Geminiani. When you think about that, Geminiani had ridden from basically the 1946 to 1960. So he went back to almost the Second World War in terms of cycling's history. So he came in at a period of time when British riders were just not making it in European cycling and weren't riding the Tour de France. And he paved the way for an entire generation because in his wheel tracks came Sean Yates, John Herity, Stephen Roach even, you know, Phil Anderson and Alan Piper, who were Australian but came across to race for the Athletic Club Boulogne-Billancourt, the famous Parisian amateur club, which became very much a home from home for a lot of English-speaking riders in the late 70s and early 80s.
Thanks to Sherwin. I mean, when I did my book on Robert Miller, I didn't know Sherwin at all at the time and never met him. All I knew about him, actually, was a strange story where he, my parents were in an airport somewhere using a bag of mine from the Tour of Langkawi, which I'd ridden in 1998. This must have been around the turn of the century. And Paul Sherwin came up and introduced himself and said hello and had a chat with him. And I think, you know, in my few dealings with him, that was my impression of him as very friendly. Affable is a word that everybody's using to describe Paul Sherwin. Always very upbeat, a very cheerful guy and very friendly. And when I contacted him, having never met him before in my life, for an interview for my biography of Robert Miller, he was incredibly generous and fascinating in terms of the stories he told me about his own career and how, having been at ACBB himself and ridden so well, the club asked him to recommend another British rider to replace him. He recommended Graham Jones. And that began a tradition, and Graham Jones then recommended Robert Miller. And Sherwin spoke about, you know, returning to the club apartments every year to check on the latest, you know, intake of young riders. It reminds me a bit of the sort of Dave Rayner house run by Jocelyn Ryan and Tim Harrison in Belgium. He had a real sense of his legacy and of, you know, kind of a mentoring role that he assumed for these young riders coming through, and it included then Sean Yates and Alan Piper and Phil Anderson and people like that. You know, and I think that came across too in a story told on Twitter by David Miller, who got a lot of help and advice from Paul Sherwin when he turned professional in the late 90s.
Shall we hear from John Herity, who was a contemporary of Paul Sherwin's? They're both from up in the northwest. Knew one another. Herity was an amateur in France just after Sherwin had turned professional, and they shared a house for a while and knew each other very well.
And he just started to ride for Orscombe Road Club, who were sponsored by a local company called Rotolac Plastics. So it was like in that area where we still had pros and amateurs, and the amateur scene was just sort of catching on to the sponsored clubs, you know, scene that was going on, and also the Royal Club did the same thing, and they put together a super team of riders, of which Paul was one of them. Interestingly, he was like probably the one that was unknown, like the new kid on the block, but he immediately became the leader of that team just because of his. It was just of his attacking style, really. He wasn't a particularly fast sprinter. He wasn't a very good climber, as we kind of all know now. But he was just, you know, he was just always there. He could, his ability to ride the front of the group was came out very, very early on in his career. And you know, one thing in particular, I remember Paul doing Bordeaux Paris one year, and I was staying in Lille at his apartment, and part of the deal was that I had to go and pick him up from Bordeaux Paris at the finish of it, sort of thing. So there's no team cars to take him home after that. You know, the guy's on a bike for whatever it was, 18 hours or whatever, and no one's there to take him home from the team. So I went there to, you know, pick him up. And he was as sick as a dog. He'd been throwing up for the last part of the race. He managed just about to climb into his own car that I'd driven there. every single service station for him to throw up. And all that he'd been given was charcoal to eat, which was a kind of a standard thing in that era to take if you had food poisoning or a stomach upset. And I remember having to hold him, his head, above the toilets in these service stations on French motorways while he was literally just throwing up this black, horrible charcoal stuff. And he'd just, like, do that, he'd come out, he'd have another mouthful of charcoal, get back in the car, and he'd doze off. We eventually got back, put him to bed, and I remember the next morning, he was up, out the door. He was out the door training again at 9:30 the next morning. And it was just, I just couldn't believe it. He'd just written Bordo Parry, and he basically got up, but I was still in bed. And he got up and went out training straight away. Now, it's debatable whether that was the right thing to do or not, but it was just typical of, you know, how he was and how such a hard, hard guy he was. And it's been a legendary ride that he did in the Tour that year where he crashed and was dropped early on in the Tour and then rode for 6 hours and finished outside the time limit. But I think it's, you know, he was let back in simply because they knew he was an honest rider. If you see what I mean, he was like, he'd give everything for it. So it doesn't surprise me that in that era that was allowed, that sort of thing could be, acknowledged, if you like, by commissaires and the organisers of the Tour that, he was reinstated. So it doesn't surprise me at all. But that's what he was. He was hard as nails. And the other one was his ability to speak languages, I have to say. He picked up languages very, very quickly. His French was like superb. I remember having the French Lara Duke team were like filling in a crossword, and Paul was getting the crossword answers quicker than they were, which was quite frustrating on their part that English bloke could do a French crossword quicker than they could, sort of thing. He was very clear on his pathway. He knew that he was going to come back to the UK and have a couple of years here in the UK, but whatever contract he was going to sign, he was going to do this commentary at the Tour de France with Phil Liggett. He struck up that sort of relationship, the lack of English-speaking riders in the Tour de France. So all of a sudden, you had this guy that was in it that was, people liked. He could speak to foreign journalists, but it gave the English journalists someone to talk to. You've been starved of it for such a long time. So he built up that relationship with both photographers and journalists, not just from the UK scene, but from all the other outlets as well. So he had a pathway. He knew what he was going to try and do at least. Did I think it would last as long as it had? I don't know if you think about that at the time, but it's staggering how long it has lasted. They were inseparable in that sort of in that format that they had. It was a way of getting into the Tour de France. So he's going to be, for sure, greatly missed.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. A reminder, you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products. Handy for the festive 500, if that's what you're doing. Go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25 at the checkout. This week's question for Ben Samuels at Science and Sport comes from Paul Wright. Hello all, thanks for such an informative and entertaining podcast, one of the highlights of the week. Or day when the Grand Tours are on. Thank you, Paul. My question for Science and Sport is, I use Rego after longer sessions, 3 hours or longer. I also take BCAAs daily unless I've taken Rego. First part of the question is, do I need to take BCAAs the days I take Rego, or does Rego include it? And the second part is, when is the ideal time to take BCAAs? Many thanks and look forward to many more excellent podcasts. Paul, over to you, Ben.
Protein is made up of a number of amino acids, some being essential that we must take in through the diet, and others non-essential that the body can synthesise. Of the essential amino acids, there are three branched-chain amino acids, or BCAAs for short. Now, Rego is a complete protein source, therefore it will contain BCAAs, and as such, Rego will be more effective in stimulating post-exercise muscle protein synthesis versus just BCAA supplementation alone. meaning that in that post-exercise window, you really want to be looking at Rego in terms of your recovery choice. In regards to when BCAAs might sit in an endurance training week, the idea of fasted or low-carbohydrate training has become a popular way to manage body composition and promote some aerobic adaptations in the muscle. But exercising in this glycogen-depleted state can mean that the body is more prone to metabolising amino acids for energy production. In this way, when programming your low-carbohydrate training session, supplementing with BCAAs before or intra-workout may satisfy the muscle mass while still promoting the desired training adaptations.
So John Herity, who until recently was the manager of JLT Condor Pro Team in Britain and has a long career as a team manager in Britain, former Great Britain team manager as well, and ex-professional and contemporary of Paul Sherwin's. I think it's worth kind of bearing in mind John's comment there that Sherwin was not a gifted climber, not really a sprinter, didn't have much of a finish, so he wasn't a prolific winner, and yet he managed to have a long career and rode seven tours, finished five of them for French teams, first Fiat and then Laredoute, in an era where there were much smaller teams. You know, elite pro teams didn't have 28 or 30 riders, they were much smaller. And so there weren't as many spaces available, and yet he managed to penetrate that very French world and made himself valuable as an upbeat character and a domestique. And you know, although his results were not sort of stellar, he, as I say, paved the way for British riders to come after him. And if you were recommended by Paul Sherwin, that was a recommendation that really meant something and resonated with people in French cycling.
Also worth mentioning, Lionel, some of his results. He was up there in the top 15 in both Paris-Roubaix and Milan-San Remo. But the word that John Herity used was robust, and his physical toughness, his ability to endure, which, as we've spoken about quite a lot, is such an important ingredient in a professional cyclist. That certainly came across in what John said, and I guess that is also what teams are looking for, especially when it comes to domestiques.
Yeah, hard as nails, John said, really. And you know, the day on the bike that Sherwin probably found the hardest was in the 1985 Tour, when he crashed right at the very start of a stage that was leaving Epinal. Bernardino was putting the pressure on at the front, and it meant that Sherwin had to ride basically 6 hours over six mountains on his own out the back with just a motorcycle outrider for company. Finished 23 minutes outside the time cut, but because he basically slogged on his own, taking his professional obligations seriously, hadn't just given up and climbed into a team car or packed the race there and then, the organisers looked on him favourably and allowed him to start the next day. And you know, again, that's a kind of that speaks volumes for his character and standing within the world, and the Tour de France in particular.
Daniel, you've been working for ITV at the Tour the last couple of years. Did your paths cross at all? Because of course, the commentary team are always sort of almost a day ahead of you, aren't they?
Yeah, they didn't really, Rich. Obviously, I'd worked on races for a number of years as a print journalist, and as you guys know, the guys in the TV compound working on TV and the guys in the press room live in sort of parallel worlds that don't really cross very much. So you don't really see the TV guys. And then 3 years ago, ITV, for whom Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin were formerly commentating, changed their commentators, and now it's Ned Bolting and David Miller. But we would still see Paul and Phil around. And I know, and I think Ned has spoken about this publicly, that where one might have imagined that Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin might have been quite put out by ITV having a sort of rethink about the direction they wanted to go in, they were very, very encouraging to Phil, to Ned and David. And, you know, the status that they had just in the TV compound and in the sport itself might have inclined you to think that they might go round with sort of airs and graces and be slightly arrogant. And from what I could tell, that was nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, they were very personable, both of them. Well, Phil is still very personable, and I was on nodding terms with Paul. That's about it. But really, no one had a bad word to say about him.
We heard a bit of my conversation earlier with Phil. Like, I had quite a long conversation with him, really. Unfortunately, his internet was down in his house, so he has to go out and stand on a hill near his house in order to take the phone calls. So it had to be quite carefully arranged and set up. And we had quite a long chat in the end. And he talked a little bit about the one thing that perhaps got Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin some criticism over the years was the way that they covered the Lance Armstrong victories and their perceived closeness to Armstrong. It highlighted a sort of difference, I think, between the role of journalist and the role of commentator. But Phil, in my conversation with him, acknowledged that they had been partly responsible for creating Armstrong, the star, and certainly, you know, bringing his story to such a big audience. You know, clearly that was their job. But also, it seemed, he acknowledged to me, almost a sense of culpability in a way that they had fed people this story, this you know, wonderful kind of fairy story that ultimately proved not to be true. And I got a feeling, you know, that was a source of regret for him, and I imagine for Paul Sherwin as well. But it made the outpouring of sympathy and, you know, all the positivity that's come the last few days all the more striking, I think, for Phil Liggett.
Yeah, I think, you know, the roles are so totally different, aren't they? I mean, Paul Sherwin, when he was commentating for Channel 4 in the early 90s, was also the PR man for the Motorola team, which, I mean, Lance Armstrong was the world champion in 93 and, you know, was a member of that team from summer of 92 onwards. So, I mean, you know, you couldn't imagine a journalist being a PR for a team.
Nor a commentator now. It's changed days, hasn't it?
Of course. But I think that's, you know, you're a product of your environment, aren't you? I mean, the cycling world was an awful lot smaller in those days. And so, they were undoubtedly responsible for the boom of Lance Armstrong in a certain way. But, I mean, let's not forget, Lance Armstrong's story was pretty compelling anyway on its own, even before the sort of the rumours of drug taking. You know, started, well, I mean, they did start pretty early, didn't they? But I mean, when you think back to Channel 4's coverage of the 99 Tour de France, when Armstrong had his backdated TUE for the corticosteroid cream, I mean, the team, Gary Imlach, went and asked those questions. You know, Phil and Paul didn't duck discussing it on air. You know, they didn't duck the Festina story as it was erupting around them. They tried to offer insight and context, and but it's a very different job, and even more so back then.
And I think, Lionel, you know, there was an undeniable conflict of interest, or two conflicts of interest, in the sense that they were Armstrong's friends, and also they were working for one of their clients. One of the people they were working for was the American rights holder who put and still puts enormous resources into their coverage of the Tour de France. And this was a patriotic story. You know, for some years and for a lot of the time when Armstrong was winning, he was the only reason that an American broadcaster was there in such force and investing so many resources into the coverage of the Tour de France. And I don't doubt for a second that they were under some pressure to cover the Armstrong story and Armstrong's dynasty in a certain way. Perhaps at times they went a little bit too far. And I also think that, you know, they were perfect for that sort of initiation of a lot of lay fans into the sport. You know, they hold their hand through those first few years of Armstrong at a time when, you know, probably most people watching weren't that interested in the minutiae and the history and the hinterland of a sport which had been almost synonymous with drug taking since the very start. And I think, you know, as fans became more knowledgeable, their role or the demands on their role probably changed, and it probably took them a while to maybe adapt to, you know, a public that was getting a lot of their information on social media, was becoming better and better informed. But, you know, I think they deserve to be cut a little bit of slack on that score.
Shall we hear a few other voices, people who, you know, worked with or knew Paul Sherwin through his life? As Lionel says, we'll hear from Luke Edwards-Evans, we'll hear from Tim Harris, who rode for Rally where Sherwin was the DS in the late 80s. We'll hear from Ian Boswell, the Katusha Alpecin rider, Orla Chenoui, a bit from Sean Yates and Francois Thomazeau. And we'll say cheerio before we hear these voices. We'll also hear a montage first of Sherwin, some of Sherwin's commentary over the years, and then we'll hear these voices. But that's all from me for this week. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
And still they appear to be slowing down quite dramatically. So Pedro Delgado racing now for the stage win, if he can come up on these riders. They're about 6 kilometres from the summit of La Plan. And still, Paul, possible for him to do the double today, isn't it?
Well, it is possible, because he's closing down them very, very quickly. He's taking something like a minute out of them every 4 kilometres. So with only 5-6 kilometres to go, it looks possible that with being only a minute behind, he could catch them with about 2 kilometres to go. If that is so, it looks very much as if Fignon actually has relaxed somewhat. So maybe he's trying to save some energy, and he will expect Delgado to come back and then try and win it in the sprint.
Radio Tour has corrected its error. It is only 50 seconds now, Stephen Rhodes, between Pedro Delgado and Parra is trying to go clear.
Just got some information through that Stephen Rhodes has now come down to 40 seconds behind this group. So he's obviously pacing himself, and he's lifting it over these last few kilometres, and he's pulling back something like 10, 15 seconds a kilometre. So he might just manage, if he doesn't crack up at all, he might just manage to pull Delgado back before the finish. This is going to be absolutely incredible.
It would be unbelievable if Rhodes could do that. Surely Paul Sherwin, Stephen Rhodes is now going to win this Tour de France.
Well, what an incredible finish by Stephen there. Who could have imagined that coming up those last few kilometres, he must have pulled everything out. He let Delgado go at the bottom. Delgado did the same thing yesterday. He attacked and cracked towards the top of the climb, and Stephen just paced himself and pulled him back incredibly over the last few kilometres of this climb. Fantastic ride there.
Once we go down off the Galibier, we run through the valley before we climb up to the finish at Les Deux Alpes, and this has caused all sorts of consternation now.
Christophe Ranero is up the road as well. He's put a great performance in this afternoon. He's trying to set the road alight for the Cofidis team. He's trying to set something up for Bobby Julich, because today is the day in the Alps that Bobby Julich said he could challenge Jan Ulrich. He's always favoured the Alps over the Pyrenees, and certainly that's why Team Cofidis have gone out. But Marco Pantani this afternoon has gone out to do something very special. But from the top of the Galibier field, there's 45 kilometres to go to the finish. That's an awful long way to go. What a move by Pantani there. He's going to pick up Christophe Ranera, who was away at the bottom of this climb now, and I'm sure he will go straight by him. But there's an awful long way to go to the finish.
Just over 3 minutes behind overall at the start of this stage. He's no longer looking for stage wins, Paul.
He certainly isn't. He's trying to blow the Tour de France apart this afternoon. Now, there is one of the stream soigneurs, I think from the Mercatoni squad. Now, that is probably an illegal move there, passing up a bottle to Pantani and also passing up a racing cape.
Well, Andy Schleck has got some respite, and what an incredible performance by Jens Voigt. He really is a man who will go out and die for the team, and that's what he's doing here. He's doing everything he can just to give his own teammates some respite, because he would like to try and set up another launch of an attack by Andy Schleck before he gets to the summit. But he must have wondered, what could he do against this man-machine? Because I think we look at man-machine Cadel Evans here this afternoon. Everything has gone right for him throughout this season. None of the bad luck that he's been dogged with in the past. And everything is being put on the line here this afternoon.
Is he good enough for a podium in Paris?
Well, I'll tell you what, Phil. If he puts 3 minutes into Frank Schleck, he will climb onto the podium in Paris at the end of today. And what a show of defiance that is after all of the bad luck that he's had in the Tour this year.
They've caused a split by about 9 riders.
Well, Chris Froome has been caught out there, and this is an amazing move by the team of Alberto Contador. Now, this just goes to show how important it is to have a strong team. Well, after yesterday's deception of being beaten by Marcel Kittel, Mark Cavendish was expecting a big bunch sprint here this afternoon, Phil. Well, there was only 14 guys left at the front of this race when he came into the line, but he made no doubt about the fact that he wanted to get that win.
You can see Cavendish is the winner of the stage ahead of Peter Sagan, who still continues to get lots and lots of points, and that's Sagan's fourth second place finish on the stage so far.
The first time I met Paul Sherwin spoke volumes of the character of the man, really, I thought. It was at the Tour Down Under. Can't even remember the year, but we're looking at maybe about 10 years ago or so. I was really very new to the world of cycling and still quite intimidated by the more experienced journalists and commentators and just trying to penetrate that world, really. And as well, being a woman coming into the sport, there weren't very many of us. There aren't very many of us now, but certainly back then there weren't. And I just remember walking along the finish line in the final day of the Tour Down Under, and Paul came down from the commentary truck and came and introduced himself, said hello, said he knew who I was, and in that manner of almost asking really if there's anything he could do for me, anything, any way he could help. And I was really touched by it because, you know, obviously you grew up in a certain generation and Paul Sherwin and Phil Liggett were the voices of cycling. They were legends in the sport. And for him to come out and be so welcoming and so kind and so generous with his time really touched me because it was completely unnecessary. I would not have noticed if he'd never come and said hello. But the fact that he did spoke volumes of the man, really. And I find his generosity, the generosity of his time and spirit, was really touching.
When I was just starting off as a white rider, late 70s, he was the man to beat. And he won Pernod, he won, I think, Folkestone for London, and these big races. You know, I'd never met him at that point, but he was, you know, the number one road man. And I remember when I was doing this criteriums post-tour, he used to make me salads and food and leave them in the fridge for me for when I got back late at night, you know. And one particular episode, he always used to get up earlier than me, and I could hear his legs creaking as he walked up and down the corridor. And one morning, he was looking out the kitchen window and he said, "Sean, there's something wrong with your car." And I came out, and I said, "Yeah, shit, it's got no wheels in it." Someone had come along and jacked it up and took all four wheels off.
I managed to wangle a trip with Phil O'Connor, a great friend of mine and photographer, when I was working on a magazine called Land Rover World in 2002. And we managed to get the expenses together from Cycle Sport and Land Rover World to go and see Paul in Uganda. Hi, I'm Luke Edwards Evans. I used to be the editor of Winning Magazine, then I was the editor of Cycle Sport. I drive a motorbike on the Tour de France with a photographer on the back. And that turned out to be the most incredible trip, not just work trip, but trip of a lifetime. Paul was fantastic and showed us everything in Kampala. We flew into Kampala and we met Catherine's wife and Alexander, his young boy. We were doing a story about Paul's two-door Range Rover, which he had acquired of his friend of his, a great friend and mentor, Frank Howitt. And Frank also was the majority owner of a gold mine about 100 kilometres outside of Kampala in a place called Torero. And we drove there in the Range Rover and looked around the mine, and Paul took us down the mine. I mean, he was just an Indiana Jones type character out there in Africa. I think that's why he loved Africa so much, because it really appealed to his sense of adventure, his sense of freedom. And a slight sense of danger out there, living in Africa. I think the whole sort of lifestyle was perfect for Paul. We had an amazing time. We did 1,000 kilometres together in that Range Rover. We drove through the Masai Mara. We did 2 hours at night to get to a campsite in the middle of nowhere in the Mara, with Paul driving like a nutcase, really, through the bush. I think there was a sense of, you know, like he was a pioneer in cycling in the late 70s, and he was doing the same thing for Africa. I think he saw himself as someone who would always be positive about Africa, and whenever anyone showed an interest, he would invite them out. You know, he would say, come out, see us, come on safari. I mean, he took Bill Liggett and Pat Liggett out on safari with Graham Watson as well one time. He knew Africa so well, and he was always wanted to pass that on, pass that enthusiasm on and that knowledge on. And it was very much a part of Paul's character to be open and friendly and inviting.
In the outpouring of grief and affection for Paul Sherwin, there's one thing that's not really been mentioned so much. Paul was very famous for being a cyclist, and he was also very famous for being one of the world's best cycling commentators. But what I haven't hardly seen written anywhere was the fact that he was also a fantastic DS. I was fortunate enough to ride for the now nearly iconic Rally Banana team in 88 and 89, where Paul was the manager and the director sportif. He'd just recently retired himself from racing and took over the reins of running the Rally Banana team. And we have quite a lot of famous riders that went on to be famous names in Great Britain. Now, Paul was a fantastic manager. I was lucky enough to become national champion riding for him, which would never have happened if I hadn't had the guidance of Paul. I think he would have gone on to be one of the world's top DSs if he'd continued to do that, because he was completely disciplined. He'd grown up in a different era, really. He'd turned professional under Raphael Germaniani for the Fiat team, I think in 77, and he'd come through the French system like so many other riders of that era. I found it very easy working with Paul because you knew where I knew where I stood, where everybody knew where they stood, and everything was perfect in that team in the respect of organisation. It was probably like one of the first teams that was like a modern team. After I'd won the national championship, I went to Spain and I rode for Festina, and it was a big contrast with Paul, because with riding with Paul, we knew exactly where we stood, what time we had to be at the airport or at the service station to go to the race, whereas in Spain it was a completely different story. He was a hard taskmaster. We didn't have foreign training camps. We used to have a training camp in the north of England, and he'd just send us off into the Peak District on big rides. Yeah, it was a different time. I'd just like to say that in my eyes, he was just a fantastic guy, and it's a tragic loss to the sport. Yeah, and obviously for his family, everything.
I wouldn't say I knew Paul very well. I mean, he was not a friend, or we were not like intimate, but I've always seen him around. I mean, I think he knew everybody in the world of cycling. Tribute to Paul Sherwin, François Thomazeau. He was like, he belonged to the world of cycling. Every time you went to a race or a major race, especially on the Tour de France, I mean, you'd see Paul around with a big smile on his face. He was always like, you know, stopping to talk to someone, cracking a joke. I mean, it was really kind of a ray of sunshine, you know, at the start, or mainly on the finish lines as well, because he spent most of his consultant career on the finish line. But it was really, I think everybody loved Paul, because he was so, you know, open-minded, always, you know, he never, ever lost his passion for cycling. As a Frenchman, there was something a little bit different from the perspective we had on Paul, because for most of the English-speaking world, I suppose, Paul was one of the voices of the Tour with Phil Liggett. And that's not at all the way we saw him in France, because obviously we're not watching the Tour on British TV. So for us, it's not his voice that stayed with us, it's his face, it's his behavior, it's his comradeship, and maybe more than everything, the way he talked, because he was a very, very gifted francophone. He spoke a very, very fluent French. Actually, he never spoke a word of English to me. He was always speaking French to me, and his French was near perfect. But it was more than that, because he spoke a very specific way, kind of French. I mean, David Miller, in a homage he paid to Paul, mentioned that the way he talked, he belonged to that, what Rupert Guinness called the foreign legend, that these, you know, Brits and Aussies and Americans, guys from the English-speaking world who came to cycling in Europe, and especially in France, in the 70s, 80s and 90s, when cycling, you know, when English was not the official language of cycling, French was at the time. So, and all these foreign legion, all these guys, all these legionnaires, you know, he spoke a very peculiar form of French, you know, full of slang words. They learned from the guys in the buses or the peloton. And the master, the grand master of the foreign legend French Academy was probably Paul. His French was absolutely perfect, full of, I don't know, full of tricks, full of great expressions, full of life, and it was always a pleasure to talk to him, because he was so, in a way, he belonged to France as much as to the rest of the world. I think he was a man of the world, Paul, and also he knew his network was so huge that he knew his way around perfectly. I remember once, it was the day before Paris-Roubaix, well, it was about 15 years ago, I think. I was covering it for the organizers, ASO. I was doing the live feed, and we were staying near between Roubaix and Lille in a place called Marc-en-Barœil. And as we didn't want to go down to Lille or Roubaix for dinner, I had a friend who was living nearby, and he said, and so I asked him, what is the best place to have dinner in the area? And he pointed to a very nice little place that only the locals knew. Probably one of the best, you know, tables in the area, but really, really, really only locally known. We got there; it was fantastic. And guess who was sitting at the next table? Paul Sherwin. I mean, if there was the best place in town, in kind of a remote little part of the north of France, well, Paul would be there. He knew his way around. He knew everybody. He knew the little spots, the best little spots in France. So yeah, France is in mourning, and French cycling are in mourning of Paul, as the rest of the world is, because he was definitely one of us.
This is Ian Boswell from Team Katusha Alpecin, and I'm reflecting on the passing of Paul Sherwin. I've been in Vermont for the last couple of weeks now, riding my bike in my basement on Zwift and watching a lot of Tour de France's, both new and old. And one thing that's consistent throughout all the editions, regardless who won, is the voice of Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin. And Paul Sherwin has just passed away. And it's really been kind of sad to think about, you know, kind of how synonymous his voice was with cycling and with, you know, my upbringing of cycling and even cycling today. You know, I've been into cycling for the last 20 years, and I've been racing at the World Tour for the last six, and Paul's been at a lot of races. He's commentated a lot of races I've been at, and he was definitely a figure and an inspiration growing up, listening to his voice. And, you know, from my childhood, listening to him commentate on Armstrong winning his seven tours, it was something that definitely kind of rung true to my desire to get into cycling. And being a Brit himself and speaking with an accent that at the time was foreign to me as a young American kid, it drew me in, and is something that the sport is really going to miss, and I hope that his voice will never be forgotten.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Matt Field.